If you're the police, where are your badges?
Badges? We ain't got no badges. We don't need no badges. I don't have to show you any stinking badges.
Forget it, Jake. It's Chinatown.
What we've got here is failure to communicate.
I'm a man. Well, nobody's perfect.
Fasten your seatbelts. It's going to be a bumpy night.
He wins, he takes the car. I win, I take his finger. Is that so strange?
Leiningen, you're up against a monster 20 miles long and 2 miles wide, 40 square miles of agonizing death. You can't stop it.
I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not going to take this anymore.
Round up the usual suspects.
Silent Breed is people!
Wait a minute. Wait a minute. You ain't heard nothing yet.
Welcome to Paleo Cinema Podcast.
Paleo Cinema Podcast looks at movies between 1895 and 1990. We cover all mainstream and genre films, books, TV, and whatever else Terry gets obsessed about. The email address is cultguru@gmail.com. That's cultguru@gmail.com. The new voicemail number is 206-350-5440. Or you can leave messages on Skype at Paleo Cinema. All lowercase and no dash. This podcast may include swearing and adult content, so if you hear anything you don't understand, just fucking Google it.
Welcome to Paleo Cinema Podcast number 81. This is Terry Frost, and for the very first time, I'm joined on the podcast by somebody I'm not married to. Everybody, Dr. Zom is here, and how are you, mate?
Fine, and I just would like to clarify that not legally married to. Legally.
Legally.
We're working on that, you know.
Well,
times
I think
change.
I think both of our cultures should get their shit together, and we should be married to podcast buddies if we absolutely want to.
Yes, yes, damn it. It must be done.
Yeah, I do have to talk it over with Sal first and get her okay on it, but I think that she thinks I'm married to my podcast anyway, so it's not too much of an extension to be married to you.
I can't do the group thing. I just can't do it. I'm just very emotional. Very, you know, in my heart, I have to give myself to only one person before, you know, it's very hard for Dr. Zom to give of himself, because I sometimes seem to be very selfish and I watch a lot of movies and scratch and, have bodily functions that some people find unappealing. But if any of you ladies out there that are listening to this show, you know, hey, just drop Terry a line and let him know if you would like a date with Dr. Zom, and we'll see if we can work something out.
That is a great title for a short film or something like that, A Date with Dr. Ugh. Zom.
Ugh.
It would hit the circuit big time.
Just thinking about it myself, I'm kind of like, you know, almost repulsed by the idea, but of anybody that would actually want to have a date with me.
It'd be a sequel to My Dinner with Andre, I believe, but yeah. Something along those lines. It'd work. You know, my people will talk to your people and we'll sort something out. Yeah.
My Brunch with Zom, you know, something like, because they've already done, you know, my Andy Kaufman already did My Breakfast with Blassie, so we have to go between breakfast and, you know, dinner or whatever, lunch. Mm. We'd find something.
Yeah, that could be followed by the sequel, you know, My Restraining Order Against Dr. Zom.
And, of course, you know, listen, you know, I'm all about equality, so, you know, it probably would be Dutch as far as, you know, paying for the meal. But then, of course, you know, you would gain points if you wanted to treat me. You know, I don't eat a lot, so that'd be good.
Absolutely. And to be honest with you, living inside the jokes, mate, it is fantastic to have you on Paleo Cinema.
Well, it's great to be here. I've been a great admirer of your work for years, and I think you do a fantastic job bringing a lot of knowledge to your listeners, not only about the films, themselves, but I love listening to you talk about and give us information on the music that accompanies a lot of these great movies.
Fantastic, and thank you for that too. And you've been a big part of it too. Your voicemails are something that it doesn't quite seem right to have a Paleo Cinema podcast without your tail ending it with your own version of wonderfulness.
Voicemails? What are you talking about?
The voicemails you send me.
Have I ever sent a voicemail to Paleo Cinema?
Once or twice, perhaps.
Okay. Hey, you know what? I think that. Yeah, okay, yeah, okay, that's good. Actually, I'll tell you what, seriously, in all seriousness, I think I missed, like, maybe the last episode or the one before that, and when I saw the new episode came out, I felt like, man, I let you guys down, but so we're making up for it because you're going to get a whole big steaming pile of Zom this time.
Absolutely, and I think T-shirts should be made up saying a big steaming pile of Zom.
Now that doesn't give me a date, you know.
We will do what we can to get you a date and to make sure that there's follow through as well.
Very good.
Absolutely. So we started off the usual way. What have you been watching lately?
Well, I was kind of in a I hate to say a lag or whatever, or I wasn't watching a lot for a while, but I made up for it, not in quality, but in quantity last night and early this morning, because Dr. Zom is a creature of the night, and so when all of you are sleeping, well, not you from down under, you're kind of on my schedule, but the people in the States, I'm usually out sucking blood when they are sleeping. First movie I watched and I'd like to speak on was called Mission Africa, also known as Commando Squad, from 1968.
Okay.
And I looked at – after I watched it, I looked at some of the reviews online, and one of the reviews – and one of the most prominent ones, and maybe the only review, was titled "The Worst World War II Movie Ever Made." I went in and for this podcast, and I wanted to do a little research on the film, and I looked up the cast, and strangely, just about everybody in the cast, when I would click on their filmography, they were in Mission Africa, also known as Commando Squad, and nothing else.
It was a sign of quality.
It definitely was, but when people talk about movies, I don't know, I wouldn't say love to hate, because I actually really enjoyed this movie, maybe not for the obvious reasons, but when you have lines like the concept is a commando squad is going to go to Africa during World War II to blow up some secret Nazi base. And they were demonstrating in a classroom, showing a film of this explosive they were going to use. And this explosive was very light. It looked like a little, rectangle, and you set a timer on it. And it was supposed to be the equivalent of 36 pieces of dynamite. And the guy said he told them that they would be wearing these strapped to their legs so that if they're captured by the Nazis won't think they won't know anything's going on. And the only thing that the Nazis might think is, because it'll make their pants look baggy. And the guy told them, and he goes, which should feed their egos about being the master race.
Ooh.
And I was like, what? Okay, so, if you're an American commando and you get captured by Nazis, more than likely, they're going to search you. And, if you got stuff strapped to your leg, they're going to find it. But, they would just probably think, boy, those Americans really have baggy uniforms. So they'd get away with it. Looked like it was shot, like I said, 1968. If several people that look like your dad and your uncles decided that they would put on their old military uniforms and get out a camera and make a movie. But it was entertaining. I will say that. It was fun to watch.
Anything else?
Got a couple more that were very much more mainstream. One of them was called Limitless with Bradley Cooper and Robert De Niro.
Yep.
It wasn't bad. I mean, it wasn't Citizen Kane or anything like that, but I kind of enjoyed it. It was like if they took the movie Charlie with Cliff Robertson, which was talked about on Paleo Cinema.
It was.
It was like Charlie on steroids. None of these movies that I'm going to talk about, I picked. I was with a group of friends, so we watched them. But it was worth a watch. It was entertaining. The next one was Drive Angry with Nicolas Cage.
I have seen that one.
I've heard mixed reviews on that. Of course, I didn't see it in 3D because I watched it on regular TV. It's one of those it-is-what-it-is movies, you know. I think, you know, I knew what they were going for, kind of a drive-in type movie. Cage was over the top. I've had a debate with Emily of Deadly Dollhouse on this. William Fichtner or Finkner? And I don't know how to pronounce his last name.
I'm checking that out on IMDb as we speak because the guy is fantastic.
Yeah, he kind of stole the show. I've really developed an appreciation for him as a serious actor. The first time, I mean, he used to be on some soap operas that my sisters watched, and that I may have watched him too. But in Black Hawk Down, where he played a Delta Force guy, he really caught my eye because I didn't expect to see him in kind of an action macho role. But he did a really good job in that. I liked it.
He's also in a great movie called What's the Worst That Could Happen from 2001, which had Martin Lawrence and Danny DeVito in it. And he played this incredibly suave detective called Detective Alex Tardio. And the guy looked like a fashion plate in it. And this is the immediate movie before Black Hawk Down. And he just steals the whole film away. It's not a fantastic film. But he's just incredibly – he's a cool mother in that movie.
Well, I saw him I'm not sure of the title. I think it might have been called, like, Drive. And it was a kind of a teen movie where – like a one-night-out movie where all things go wrong and weird and strange. And the guys are out partying. And And I don't remember all that much about it, except that he, I think at one time, was completely naked. One of the guys, he said, you know, well, you know, I'll help you find, you know, give you a ride to help you find your car or whatever. And while the guy's waiting for him, he goes, I got to go get my keys. He comes back out and he's like completely buck naked, and ends up him and his wife were swingers, and they wanted to get a little this and that going on, and the guys were like in shock and kind of in horror and got the hell out of there. But he was good in that.
I'll watch him in anything. I love the guy.
Yeah, and he's the kind of guy that I would almost love to see someone give him a chance at, you know, the lead role in a movie because he has acting chops. I mean, there's no doubt about that. Now, whether people would accept him, I mean, it would depend on what kind of vehicle they put him in. But, I mean, he can bring it, and he does. I mean, even in shitty movies, he brings it, you know, so.
Totally agree with you on that one. So anything else, or is that just about the
memorable stuff? I have two more that are kind of connected by one actor. And the one was something I did not ever imagine that I would want to watch if I had my choice. Not that it was horrible, but it was called Take Me Home Tonight, starring Topher Grace.
Ooh.
And one reason when it started up was it took place in 1984, and that was the year that I graduated from high school. So I kind of related to a lot of the music and stuff like that. But the only really thing in it that was worth anything was Michael Biehn was in it. He played Topher Grace's dad, who was a cop. Not much to say about that movie other than it ties into the next movie, which was The Rock with Nicolas Cage from previously, mm-hmm. Drive Angry, and Michael Biehn, who was in Take Me Home Tonight, and a damn hell of a damn fine cast. I'm not a big fan of The Bay, but I remember watching this movie for the first time and really enjoying it, and I hadn't seen it in a long time and turned it on last night, and still, I like it. Other than the fact that I kind of sat there and watched the big car chase at the beginning when Sean Connery, when he was escaping, and he was driving this Humvee, and the line was, "He's hitting everything in sight trying to stop us." That Humvee must have been made of adamantium because it didn't have a dent in it. And Cage was chasing after him in a Ferrari, hitting just about everything. He went through a building to get in front of Connery, and he goes, "Ah, what the hell?" And he guns it through a plate glass window. But, you know, you'd suspend disbelief, but, you know, the plate glass window had about a, I don't know, 2.5 feet, maybe 3 feet brick base around the bottom of the building, and unless they had a ramp set up so where someone could drive it through the window. But I'm picking, you know, fly shit out of Sugar Bowl. So, but it was fun.
Yeah. The thing I never understood about The Rock was I've been to Alcatraz, and I don't remember any flamethrowers underneath it shooting through little tunnels and things like that. I totally missed that part of the tour.
And why would they? Okay. Now, I know they said that they had turned Alcatraz into a tourist attraction because that was the concept. Ed Harris, who was really good in it too, was holding those people hostage, the tourists. And I can't remember why, you know, or what the excuse was even in the movie, why they had these giant flame shooting video game, like it was, you know, basic video game thing. Okay, you have to time it, you know, whatever. But my thing with that movie is I always in the back of my mind wished almost at the end that they would have almost just gave a little suggestion or a little hint that the Connery character was actually the James Bond character. And this is what happened to him so many years, you know, he dropped off the map without even saying it, just kind of hinted at it, you know.
Yeah, absolutely. The one thing they do say about Alcatraz, they never say about Alcatraz in a movie, is the place smells like bird shit. Every inch of the place smells like bird shit.
From seagulls and pigeons and everything. Just being
seagulls and pigeons and seagulls and pelicans and everything else. It just totally smells like bird shit. But there is that theory about James Bond, too, that James Bond's actually a job title and not a guy because each time they change the guy, he takes on the persona of James Bond. So the job title of major assassin for the British government is James Bond.
Which I always liked that concept from the, you know, the great, I don't know if I would say the great failure of the original Casino Royale, where they had all the different directors. The whole concept was, you know, David Niven was the original, and then he retired, and they had a different guy and a different guy. It's almost like what was the movie with the car movie with David Carradine where he was Frankenstein? And every time Frankenstein got killed, they would just replace him with another guy to keep the legend going. Death Race.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, I'll occasionally watch The Rock. I think we've got it on DVD here. We actually paid for it, which is an unusual thing for a piece of film these days. But, it's got some chops, but I think that Bay has definitely gone downhill, and of course there's that scandal at the moment with the new Transformers where he's reused and digitized footage from, what was that movie, The Island?
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, with Ewan McGregor and Scott.
Yeah, they used a bit of the car crash footage from that, digitally fucked it around with it, and put it into the third Transformers movie.
While I have you as a captive audience, Mr. Frost, I was wondering, what did you think of that movie, The Island, with Ewan McGregor?
I saw it, and I remember little bits of action, but it doesn't really stick in my memory because apart from anything else, it's got Scarlett Johansson in it, who looks great, but mm-hmm. has about as much character as a piece of A4 paper.
Yeah, yeah. I agree with that, and because as I asked that question, I was sitting here thinking, okay, what did I think of that movie? And nothing really jumps out other than it had almost like a Logan's Run-ish feel, just because it was the main protagonist, a man and a woman, who had just kind of met, and they were on the run. But yeah. I don't remember. All I remember is, of course, lots of running, lots of explosions, stuff like that. But I did, was Scarlett Johansson? Yeah, she definitely is a tasty looking peach. But that's what, like when Woody Allen consistently is putting her in these movies. She's just, you know, for me, and I hate to say this because I don't want to sound sexist, because everyone knows that Dr. Zom loves women and respects them fully. But the term eye candy is about the only thing I can think of when I think of her.
Yeah, she's got that really kind of negative thing. The Michael Bay films increasingly for me are, when you see them, you feel like an insect taped to the front bumper of one of two cars that's colliding.
Over and over.
Yeah. All there is this inexplicable metal around you shattering against each other. And there's no context. There's no human part of the film. It's all sound and fury signifying nothing.
Okay. Well, like one of my friends, and it must be a generational thing as far as – because he's probably about 10 years younger than me. And he was so excited by the original Transformers movie. Oh, my God, you got to see this. We got to go see it. We'll go the first night it comes out and everything. And I even from the word go, I didn't have that excitement because I never watched Transformers, the cartoon. And all I knew of it was that, you know, they had the toys or the action figures, whatever you want to call it. Don't want to insult anybody.
Toys.
Yeah, toys. And let you do that. And then and then they had the, like, you know, whenever it was on, cartoon. But I just didn't get that, you know, thing. And then when I watched it, I literally, you know, I don't even know if I made it through a quarter of the movie. And, you know, Megan Fox, again, just another, you know, piece of eye candy. But even that didn't hold me, you know. It just seemed like lots of robots crashing into each other.
Absolutely. Anyway, I'll go on to what I've been watching.
Okay.
I watched You Only Live Twice again, classic James Bond. My theory, though, is that You Only Live Twice is the film where the franchise started dipping down.
Right.
And even though it's got the script by Roald Dahl, and it's got one of the best Bond lines ever, where he's in the bathtub with the Japanese girls bathing him.
Right.
And they've got the great big sponges with all the soap on it. And one of them dips the sponge down below his waist and looks down and says, "Don't get soap in my eye."
I liked the fact that they were – of course, you know, he was in Japan at the time and everything. Yep. He's considered a gaijin, and he was such a barbarian that he actually had hair on his body, you know.
Yeah. That's in the book, though. That's definitely part of the book. Yeah. So
well, that's the whole thing, you know.
Yeah, absolutely. But I enjoyed that. We can have an increasing awareness that that's where things dip down. And the next thing I saw was The Big Fix with Richard Dreyfuss, which has got a great ensemble cast. I mean, they've got John Lithgow in it, Susan Anspach is in it, Bonnie Bedelia is in it. F. Murray Abraham has a great turn as an Abby Hoffman kind of character. Mm. And I've got a fondness for the film. I don't think it's a great detective movie. It's a, kind of, you know, like a reformed hippie becomes a private eye kind of film. But it's got a bit of chops, and I kind of like it for that.
I always like Dreyfuss. I remember the first time that he really came into my, you know, knowing who he was when The Goodbye Girl first came out. And I vividly remember him, you know, sitting – again, this is a reoccurring theme on this podcast, sitting buck naked and Marsha Mason walking in on him, and the only thing he has covering him is his guitar. But, I mean, he's been in several really good movies, and he also even played the devil, or actually maybe, depending on your, you know, your religious beliefs, maybe a spawn of the devil, because he did play Dick Cheney in the Oliver Stone Nixon movie. So,
I've got a lot of time for him. And I love the cameo in Piranha 3D as well.
Yeah. When I first saw that, one of my friends showed me the I think it might have been the trailer, and I thought, before I heard them say his name or anything, I thought, oh my God, that would be so cool if they made him Matt Hooper. Because, I mean, that was such a defining role for him.
It was, even though he was coked out of his skull at the time, he did fantastically well.
Can you imagine being on the set with Richard Dreyfuss coked out of his skull and Robert Shaw, who is, I've heard this, and since you are a master of cinema, you might be able to confirm this. I heard that Robert Shaw might have had a drinking problem.
He was an Irish actor in the 1960s and 70s.
Well,
of course he had. Yeah.
He actually had, I think, though, because he continually was working, he always had money to buy alcohol. So you really don't have a problem as long as you still have money to buy it.
Yeah, but all those guys, I mean, the only one still surviving is Peter O'Toole, and that's because he's partly made out of leather. but the rest of them, right?
Yeah.
All the hard-drinking guys, Ollie Reed, of course. And I'm going to play an Ollie Reed clip in this podcast. I'm going to slip it in as an interstitial from Triple Echo with Ollie Reed going dippy, 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 dipping an acorn into some honey.
Hey,
so I'm gonna slide that in there because it's just a little thing that my friend Ivor Cole over at ABC Darwin made me aware of, and I found the clip and sent him a copy of it because it's just a crazy little audio clip and very weird in the context of that film.
Open the old honey pot and a little bit of a dippy, 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 eh?
Not to sidetrack because you're on your films, but Peter O'Toole, did you happen to see the movie? Was it Venus, which was like kind of a comeback for him, sort of?
I saw half of it. I caught the tail end of it on cable, and I think it's still showing on cable here. So I'm going to have to record it because I do want to see it because it's got him and it's got Leslie Phillips in it.
Mm-hmm.
And just seeing those two guys playing off each other's, the bits I saw of the film are a lot of fun. So it's definitely on there. I did see him in a movie called Creator, which he did with Mariel Hemingway.
Ah. I'm familiar with that one. I haven't seen it. I bought Venus at a local, all the local video stores are going kaput. And I really enjoyed it. It's a sentimental movie, but as we tend to get older, of course, at the time, I think, my God, I don't know how old he was at the time, but he appeared to be like maybe in his late 70s, maybe like 80 or something like that. And just a lot of the stuff that he was feeling about his manhood and about things changing and how I've often told some of my friends, I said, as a man and you start getting older, it's not like that you don't look at someone who is much younger than you and think, oh my God, that she's so beautiful or sensual or whatever. But then reality hits you in the face. And I was telling one of my friends one time, we went to a baseball game like last week. And of course it's summertime and everybody's walking around and the girls are, looking lovely. And I just looked at him and he said, oh, look at this young lady walking by. And I said, my God, do you realize that we'll never, ever, ever have that again? So Peter O'Toole in Venus, thumbs up, man. Yeah. You were right spot on.
Absolutely. Anyway, we're going to take a break now because we've been 28 minutes into it so far. Just you and I shooting the shit. So we'll do that. I'll quickly get through the other films that I saw. Okay. And we'll get on to the first of two films. I think maybe we do Hotel first. What do you reckon?
I'll leave that to your discretion. And so I can get my notes in order.
Some think the world is made for fun and frolic, and so do I, and so do I. Some think it well to be all melancholic, to pine and sigh, to pine and sigh. But we love to spend our time in singing some joyous song, some joyous song, to set the air with music bravely ringing is far from wrong, is far from wrong. Listen, listen, echo sounds of awe. Listen, listen, echo sounds of awe. Vernacular, 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 vernacular. Echo sounds of awe, vernacular, vernacular.
The Mills Brothers with Funiculi, Funicula. Okay, quickly what I'm going to do now is go through the other films that I've seen because Zom and I are having such fun. We've kind of drifted and we've got to get this back on course. I saw Source Code, which I recommend. Good science fiction film. I saw Scaramouche again with Stuart Granger. Fantastic film. I did see another movie that I recommend called Hannah. The one about the teenage spy chick who was trained to be a spy by her father.
And you,
you seen them?
No, I'm waiting for it to come out on DVD over here. Did you like it?
I did. It's got Cate Blanchett and Eric Banner in it.
Love Cate Blanchett. She is I don't want to say a guilty pleasure, but just a fantastic actress and just incredibly beautiful in her own way. If that sounds, you know, I have a thing for Cate Blanchett. That's what I'm trying to say.
Absolutely. Well, in this one, you should like her. I did see the last Harry Potter film, too. I'm going to do a spoiler of Voldemort Dies.
What?
Yeah, absolutely.
I just listened to Ralph Fiennes getting interviewed on the Kermode show. And yes. It was funny because when they were interviewing him, it actually came to a point where they were asking him about his character, you know, and most Harry Potter fans would probably expect him to be like, well, the character is this and that. And he was like, I really didn't have any idea. You know, it was almost kind of like a confession. Hey, you know, I played the part. I don't, you know, study everything about the character, you know, whatever.
Yeah.
But it was a funny, you know, little faux pas.
Yeah, I think Voldemort's a very kind of underwritten character in a lot of ways. He's just a two-dimensional villain.
Right.
Bring me Harry Potter. Yeah, there's a lot of that kind of stuff. It's just like the dirty old man lives across the road kind of thing.
Bring me Terry Frost.
Yeah, that kind of shit. Okay, really quickly, the rest of them. Saw Ministry of Fear, the Fritz Lang movie with Ray Milland, which is a bit of fun. Let me see. I did see Night of the Lepus, the giant rabbit movie from the early 70s, which was based on a novel by an Australian, Russell Braddon, called The Year of the Angry Rabbit.
Nice.
And today I saw Pandorum, science fiction film with Dennis Quaid and Ben Foster in it.
Yes, I saw that.
I kind of, so on it. I wasn't really great on it.
Kind of, if I remember, kind of horror-ish science fiction on a, was it kind of spaceship-y?
Yeah, a lost spaceship and the guys wake up from the deep freeze and everything's gone to shit and it gets better in the end.
Yeah.
Yep. Anyway, on to Hotel. 1967 Technicolor film. This is, I'm reading from the Wikipedia at the moment. Directed by Richard Quine, who didn't direct a lot of films.
Mm-hmm.
And based on a novel by Arthur Haley. Stars Rod Taylor, Catherine Spark, Carl Malden, Kevin McCarthy, Michael Rennie, and Melvin Douglas. So, so have you got anything like a synopsis for this one, or do you want me to run with it?
Just off the top of my head, a synopsis without reading it off of IMDb or whatever.
Yeah.
This is a movie about a luxurious, an old and respected luxurious hotel in New Orleans, and about the everyday goings on with the staff and how their jobs and the things that they have to do, and the guests, and it's a lot of stuff going on all at once, but a very enjoyable movie, and also a lot of manipulation, a lot of business things going on as they are dealing with possibly having to sell the beloved hotel that the characters work in.
Yeah, absolutely, and So I'll just go through the things I liked about the film, and then we can go with what you liked on it. First off, the piano bar with Carmen McRae singing in the piano bar. Fantastic jazz singer. They went to the top. They got Carmen McRae, who didn't do many films, if any other ones, but has always been one of my favorite jazz singers.
Mm-hmm.
And she's just great in there. She's a kind of sounding board a bit for the character played by Rod Taylor, who's the manager of the hotel. His character's name is McDermott.
Mm-hmm.
And, it's just a fantastic thing to see Carmen McRae in a film and hear her sing, too, because she had a pure, very lovely voice.
Just because you're really familiar with her, and this is the first time I saw her, I believe at one point, and I wasn't sure if I heard it right or not, when McCarthy's character – or somebody was talking to Rod Taylor and they heard – as they walked by, heard her singing, and he said, "Is that the Delta Queen?" Now, was that just like a nickname for the character? Was that an actual name that she used or was known as in real life or –
That was the bar.
Okay, that was the bar.
Yeah,
because
there's a sign above there that says Delta Queen, yeah.
Okay. One of the reasons that I wondered that is because there was a paddle boat that was called the Delta Queen, and where I'm from, on the West Virginia-Ohio border in the United States, the Ohio River, which is a main tributary or our main river, has a lot of barges bringing things up and down, a lot of boats and everything because it's such a big river. One of the big paddle boats that would always be around or would be docked around there was called the Delta Queen, and it was really something to see. And when I heard that, I thought immediately, cool, Delta Queen. That goes right to Zom's roots.
It does, and if you check the movie out again, there's a sign that says Delta Queen. Yeah.
I must have missed that.
There.
Yeah.
I think it's over the Oyster Bar part of the bar. You go in there, and there's a cocktail bar and that kind of thing. But Carmen McRae adds a nice touch of class to this film.
Mm. When I first saw her, honestly, the first thing I thought was she looked incredibly like Lieutenant Uhura from the original Star Trek. You know,
she's got that. She's got the same kind of classic beauty and the beautiful bone structure. Yeah. And other things I liked about it, Catherine Spark, not a great actress, but she was pretty sexy in this film.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, she. I don't think I had ever seen her in anything. I know she did a lot of TV, I believe. Mm. But yeah, she had. I mean, she. Do you know how old she was in this movie?
I'm going to find out in about 3 seconds.
Okay, because what I was going to say was she really had she was very youthful, had a very youthful beauty, and the eyes were just incredible.
22.
Ah, see, and that just shows you, and I'm not saying anything good or bad, I'm not making any judgments, but Hollywood, in today's Hollywood, you'll often see a 60 or 70 year old Sean Connery and with a love interest of Catherine Zeta-Jones. They, no matter how old the actor is, they seem to go a lot with, you know, putting them with a much, much younger actress.
Yeah.
I liked this because I thought her and Rod Taylor had a lot of chemistry. But, you know, like I said, just saying something, I would like to see them kind of get away from that, because there are a lot of fantastic actresses out there of all ages, and I'd like to see them get a lot, you know, get more roles where they're, you know, portrayed with people of their own, you know, it's more believable.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely, and I totally agree. When you said that, the thing that I was thinking about was Rod Taylor in the VIPs from 63 with Maggie Smith.
Yeah.
And they were kind of an age, and she played his secretary, and he was a big magnate.
Well,
And the rapport there, he seemed to be very comfortable with these leading ladies and built a fantastic rapport with them.
Well, that's the thing that always strikes me with Rod Taylor, and I've said this before. I think maybe if I left feedback or whatever on a podcast known as Paleo Cinema, which is one of the finest podcasts on the internet.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. One thing about Rod Taylor, because I've been a fan of his since I was a wee sprig, is when I look at him, he has it all. He is not so good looking that men hate him or, you know, are like, you know, want to beat him up or whatever because he gets all the women because he's so good looking. He has a rugged look, a man's man kind of look. He can play the tough guy. He's charming. He's witty. He's the kind of, I mean, he has something for everyone. And I could see where, that's what I was going to say as far as what I was talking about the age difference or whatever. It doesn't throw this off one single bit, because you could see a younger, attractive lady seeing this guy, and he's got it all together, and he's got confidence. He's classy. Like I said, you could tell he's kind of a, you know, could handle himself, has a macho thing, but not so overpowering that he's obnoxious with it. Rod Taylor, man, he was, something else. I really, really admire just his charisma.
Yeah, and I got a great report from him, because he was, in my childhood, the only Australian big Hollywood movie star.
Yeah.
And he was born about 10 kilometers from where I was born.
Yeah.
So, anything Rod Taylor came in, it got a big plug in Australia in the 60s. And we were very proud of him because of that, because there's nobody else really out there doing things. There are a couple of character actors.
Right.
But no big male Australian star apart from Rod Taylor. And films like he did Sunday in New York with Jane Fonda.
Mm-hmm.
Fantastic little comedy. Dark of the Sun, of course. You and I talked about that off air. And seeing him in Inglourious Basterds.
Yeah.
Playing Churchill. It was just a groovy thing. I mean, he's paid his dues. He's retired.
Right.
He likes a little bit of a drink. He's worked with Hitchcock. He's worked with John Ford.
Yeah.
He's worked with the best of them and had built himself a lovely career there. And, he's just – I think he should be – even though he doesn't live in Australia now and hasn't for 50 years,
right,
he should be considered a national treasure by Australians.
I mean, he could flawlessly play, an American. I never even realized that because I grew up watching him with John Wayne, in The Train Robbers or something like that. Or he played in the movie Chucka with Ernest Borgnine. And I mean, these are Westerns, and for me, looking at Rod Taylor, I'm like, man, this guy is an all-American hero. And then I find out later he's not American. But, yeah, just great.
Yeah, you should try to find his first film, King of the Coral Sea, where he's got this beautiful pencil mustache on.
Nice.
And it stars with Chips Rafferty, the other Australian character actor. Australian film. There weren't many being made at the time, but he's kind of very suave and has his shirt off a lot in that film. And Rod Taylor's absolutely amazing. And the other thing that I really liked about this film was Rod Taylor's bachelor pad.
Yeah. They always say on the Gentleman's Guide, it's like his bat cave, his lair.
It's a beautiful place. And there's a great tracking shot where he goes to make the drinks and leaves the girl there and makes the drinks, comes back, and it pans back to the fact that she shed most of her clothing. And she's looking over his record collection. All it done in one shot.
Right. And because Rod Taylor is so smooth and so charismatic and so confident, he didn't do what I would have done, which would be drop both drinks and take a big gulp where you could see my Adam's apple go, but that's just me. That's part of my charisma, my charm.
Yeah. What he did do, though, is he did a little comedy thing of fumbling with the blender when he was making the cocktail.
It just adds a little touch of humor. That was nice.
It does. And the ensemble in this film is fantastic. And it is one of those things where you've got 15 different plots all working themselves out. You've got people like Richard Conte in the film.
Mm.
I always liked
Richard Conte, because in a lot of the movies that I would see him in, which were these noir classics, he talked almost like a typewriter. It'd be like, Richard Conte's in this movie. He's going to be in this movie again. And then he's in another movie. And then like if he's interrogating somebody, it's just like ding, 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 ding. I mean, rat-a-tat-tat kind of, I always liked him. He's pretty good. And interesting role in this, because as you said before, there's so much going on, but the way that it's shot, it's not overwhelming. You don't go back and think, I remember them showing this before. They keep it flowing, and they keep involved with all the different things,
Yeah, there's just so many good bits. We haven't mentioned one of the main interesting actors is Carl Malden,
mm-hmm.
and playing a hotel thief.
I enjoyed. I've always enjoyed. I don't know if I could think of a movie, maybe a movie, the actual whole movie that he was in that I didn't really think was that great. But his performance in just about everything I've seen him in was just fantastic. And he, of course, never had Hollywood good looks, but he had that everyman look. And in this movie, one of the reasons that I really enjoyed his role, because he basically is a grifter, a thief. Mm. I mean, he's basically a thief looking for a way constantly to make a buck, steal a buck. But everything he did it with this almost like half grin smile. Like he's enjoying the fact. Yeah. He is so good at what he does. He's got it down to such a science. And even a few times where he is in peril of being nabbed, he gets away, and you can just tell that's part of the part of the juice for him. That's part of the excitement.
Yeah. And he does a robbery and goes through it and gets like 47 bucks out of it and curses credit cards.
Yeah. That was a nice, I hate to see that guy in today's society if you thought it was back then. Ooh. But
Yeah.
The several times it was almost like I was sitting on the edge of my seat because for anybody who hasn't seen it, the movie, he was almost like a cat burglar. He would actually be in the room and the people would be sleeping in their beds and he'd be standing right there. He'd be right in the room picking up things right off their dressers, and it just almost gave me a creepy feeling because you know, you would be so vulnerable, and if you were in a sound sleep, you know, thinking that, God, somebody was just in there doing all this stuff and you didn't even know it.
Yeah, and it's just a joy to see him. He's enjoying the acting, obviously. His character's enjoying the stealing and things like that. But, it's just good to see him in that kind of slightly different role for Mulder. And that, but one of the things I noticed what rewatching the film too is there's an ongoing theme of change in the film. The hotel needs to change, and there are new kinds of hotels which are represented by the Kevin McCarthy character who wants to buy the hotel, and the main characters are getting changes in their life. There's just a theme of change through the whole thing and kind of ultimately embracing that change and building something new out of the things that you can't control the arc of.
Right. On that note, the new modern age, the new modern type of businessman, McCarthy, you know, he's kind of arrogant. He's kind of obnoxious. He literally prays to his God and has his subordinates get down on their knees, hold hands, and pray that his business dealings are going to be successful. And that was so, you know, I was like, oh, my God, this is so repulsive. But and then that kind of modern day businessman, modern day for that time. But then on the other hand, you had, Taylor and not Ralph.
Melvin Baker, Douglas.
Melvin Douglas.
Melvin Douglas, Ralph, yeah.
As they're in business too, they're in business to make a buck, but they are of a different time because they had, you know, the morals, the principles, the pride, and things like that to me was almost like a change thing. And they were, even though they saw that this change is inevitable, it's going to happen, they still had their pride, they still had their values and their principles that they really weren't willing or maybe ever willing to give up, you know, for a buck.
And ultimately they move on to a different phase of their life in the arc of the film. And kind of make an accommodation to that change.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah. Change is coming. It's that the world is going to change no matter what, and no matter how you resist it. And we were talking about that off the air. Some people are, and I think it's mainly because they're scared. And,
oh, absolutely.
Yeah, and a lot of times because they wax nostalgic of times. When in reality, the times they're remembering weren't really all roses and peaches, and you know, it's coming, and if you don't bend, you're going to break.
Yeah, I mean, 10 years ago, I used to curse the fact that movies weren't as good as they used to be, and that cinemas weren't as nice as they used to be, and all those sort of things. But then I had this phase change when I did the podcast, saying I can bring some of that into the new media and into the 21st century way of thinking by podcasting about it, and getting people to appreciate those things that I first saw as a kid or saw on TV later, and all those powerful influences that I had.
Right.
And repackaging it to embrace change rather than bitch about it.
Well, that's one thing that I, not, and Terry only gave me like $5 or $6 to say this. No, not really.
Thank you.
But that's one reason that I really like Paleo Cinema is because I see so much today, whether it's music, whether it's sports, cinema, where people are only aware of the present. And they don't try to seek out the history and the rich history. I have several friends that are like, oh, that's an old movie. Yeah, I have no interest in it. I only want to watch the very new things that are coming out that are for, you know, attention spans of less than, you know, 20 minutes.
Yeah.
But there's so much out there. And your podcast, I know personally, speaking only for myself, that you've talked about several movies that I didn't even know existed, several movies that I don't know if I would have ever sought them out until I heard you talking about them. And, you know, even genres where I'm like, you know, I don't know if I'd want to watch this. This is a movie that's more of a I mean, even The Hotel. Or Banning, the two movies we're covering. A few years ago, might not have even known they existed, and if one of them happened to be on TV, I'm not sure if I would have watched it because I was more into, you know, the really gritty 70s, you know, Serpico and dramas like The Deer Hunter and stuff like that. I was really into that, or action or something like that that I grew up on. But now I, you know, through your podcast and through a lot of the other podcasts, I'm seeing that there's a whole generation of youngsters out there, no offense to all my friends on Facebook and through all the other podcasts, that are really digging the old stuff. And I'm glad to see it because then they can carry it on to the next generation.
Absolutely. Tom Wolfe had a name for that. This kind of headspace that people get just only wanting to see the new things. Mm-hmm. He called it information ricochet, which is nostalgia for something that only just happened.
Right.
And it's an important concept to have because I've met people that said, I don't watch black and white movies, I can't get into them.
Yeah.
And you just kind of go, you fuckwit.
I never understood that because, first of all, growing up, I mean, for a great length of time, we only had a black and white TV.
Mm.
But I can still see this movie. I can still see these characters. I can still see these actors. I can still – the story – a good story is a good story. That's like people say, well, I don't read, you know, or I, as far as music goes, the same thing. A good story is a good story. I don't care if it was made in 1930 or 2011.
Yeah. That's I've heard people say that too, that I don't read. And the only answer you can have to that statement is, how do you order at restaurants?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, you know, you pull up to the drive-thru and point at a picture maybe. I don't know.
Yeah, but I mean, learning, I mean, I've always had this thing, because I'm self-educated, of continual learning. And people who resist learning infuriate me more than most things do these days. People who willfully resist embracing change or willfully resist picking up new information or gaining new skills and all that. It's just one of those things that I find really annoying and a kind of abrogation of the responsibility you've got for having a big brain.
Right. Well, those are the – I mean, you know, and I don't want to get too deep into this, but those are the same people that like to be led and that are easily misled.
I totally agree with that. So just to summarize, are there any other things you want to say about this film or anything that really grabbed you on it?
One thing just – I mean, right off the beginning, I love the intro. Basically, it's an artwork or a painting of a hotel, and they start at the bottom and they pan up. And each floor, there, you know, a lot of the rooms, the windows are black, but then the one will be lit, and you can see something going on there. Go up to the next, and the next, and the next, and you see different things going on in the windows. But the music, the you know, orchestral music was excellent. And I like when they were doing this and they were panning up and they were showing the titles, it would actually say, you know, Rod Taylor as hotel manager, you know,
Catherine Spock.
Catherine Spock. It would say Girl from Paris, Carl Malden, Key Thief. And the first time I watched this, I thought, okay, are they actually going to go to the lengths of never naming these people, and just you're going to know them by, but they didn't. You know, they actually have their names, but I liked how they did. That was just a little subtle thing. I liked, well, I mean, just the hotel. Just fantastic. Yeah. When I travel some, and, you know, you stay in even the, like, a Hilton or something like that, it's very generic.
Yeah.
And, of course, in this movie, that's one thing they were discussing, because McCarthy's character, it's basically what he was going to turn this place into, a generic kind of and he even says this, you know, we're going to have everything on a conveyor belt, which still is all this money now, you know. You're going to get your bill on a conveyor. You're going to get your room service on a conveyor. But every little space, the lobby of this place is just fantastic, just beautiful.
Huge. It's a lovely set.
Oh, beautiful.
Yeah.
And his idea was, you know, it's almost like this ultra, you know, capitalist thing. Yeah, this is just a complete waste of space. You know, we could put shops down here and milk even more money out of our people. Don't have these big fancy chairs that are so comfortable, that look beautiful, for the guests to sit on in the lobby, because if they're going to sit, they need to go in the restaurant, or, you know, just to milk more money. It was all about money, all about greed. And like I said before, you know, the manager and the owner of the hotel were – Melvin Douglas were – they were so old school. And you really got the feeling that they had been there. I mean, these are just actors doing a part, but they sold it to the point where you really felt like, okay, this – Melvin Douglas has had this hotel forever. I mean, it's part of him. It's part of his life. And Rod Taylor, and this is another thing I liked. It was kind of the relationship between those two, because he had brought Rod Taylor up from pretty much next to nothing, and was by them telling the little backstory. I don't know if it was McCarthy or whoever was telling, you know, because he was he was trying to buy the hotel, so any little bit of information to manipulate. And they told Rod Taylor's story and how he had moved up. And it's like Melvin Douglas's character actually was kind of like a father figure to him, because he actually even ended up sending him to college to learn the business. And so they had that connection. Even though McCarthy was always continually just looking for the edge and trying to manipulate the situation, I always felt – throughout the entire movie that, you know, this isn't – this Taylor, they could have probably thrown $1 million at him. But he, you know, there was a connection there that was more than just a business thing. I know – I wanted to say the costumes I thought were great, but of course, this movie actually took place in this time. But still, I loved the richness of the wardrobes that people wore back then. And, you know, even at first when I wrote that down, I thought, you know, these are people staying in a high-class hotel, so everybody is going to be walking around in these, you know, nice suits and dresses. But it's nice to see a lady, a beautiful lady dressed like a beautiful lady, you know. Dressed nice. There were a couple of things that really surprised me about this movie, and I don't know why. Because what was this, 1967, but
it was.
Maybe it's because most of the time when I would see movies like this, I would see them being shown on TV, but this movie took place in 1967, and we did see some things that I didn't expect. A few scenes took place in like strip bars, or, you know, strippers. Then there was actually a scene where some prostitutes were hired to go up to a room full of guys, which later on they showed them in various forms of undress, or beginning to be, which, you know, I hate to say it, but the only thing I could think of was, okay, this is basically showing that they, you know, prostitution, and, you know, these guys are going to have like an orgy or something. There was a... In 1967, this was ripe for this subject, but they actually did have a bit of a racial civil rights subplot, kind of a thing. Yeah, which was kind of nice to see that they actually – it wasn't something – well, I mean, it was pretty prominent on the face of it. And, you know, I for some reason, I don't know, maybe it's because I thought, you know, this is a major Hollywood movie and they wouldn't want to have something controversial, but they did, you know, so I like that.
Yeah, it was integrated well too. Even there were problems with integrating the hotel. We can give that away as a plot point. But the fact that every person of color who worked for the hotel was treated with respect by the hotel management was an interesting dichotomy. They couldn't stay in the hotel, right, but the management treated them like people and treated them with respect as the people doing their jobs well.
Well, and another, and this is probably the last thing I wanted to add on this. Actually, two things, because I just spotted another one.
That's okay.
The hotel, to me, as I was watching it, I could almost see it almost like a ship at sea. And the way it was run, and the owner was almost like the Commodore, and Rod Taylor was the captain of the ship. He was a hands-on guy, and all the people, to me, it was almost like the sailors and the people working on the ship, and he was going around and he was making sure that everything was being done, or almost like a general, how he – the way that he had to run this place to keep it functioning, to keep on top of things. And but he wasn't really when I say that, I don't want people to think that, you know, his character was an asshole who was constantly up, you know, chewing people out or whatever. He ran a tidy ship. And I just like that feel, because I that's the feel I got from it was, I mean, they could have made this and it could have been like I said, a ship. It was basically full of people and it was an entity. The whole hotel was almost like a living organism, because there were constantly things going on and things being managed and things being done. It was a never-ending, you know, cycle for the people that worked there.
Yeah, and the Rod Taylor character, Peter McDermott, knew the place upside down. He knew exactly what was right, what was wrong. He knew that certain people were scamming certain things. Yeah, basically, it was a lovely put together thing. I think that's because the structure is based on the novel,
right?
And then the novel subplots came into it somewhere.
Yeah, and like you said, there were even. It's not like everybody that worked under him was, you know, licking his boots and like, oh my God, he's the greatest guy in the world. He's the most fantastic. I mean, there were some people that were, you know, he had to kind of keep his eye on and, you know, tell him, hey, listen, you know, you need to do this. Well, I'm doing this. No, you need to do it. The last thing that I wanted to add, because this really just caught my eye, was I saw somebody in the movie that I was like, I know that guy from somewhere. And then I realized that it was Klaatu. Who played the Duke, and I was like, holy shit, it's Klaatu, you know.
Yeah, and he had one of the good suntans in the movie. There are a few people with some really great suntans in this film.
When McCarthy's character just kind of, with the exception of the praying thing, but like, they would come up for a business meeting, and he'd be sitting there with his shirt completely unbuttoned, holding in his stomach and rubbing it, even in one part he had a suit on, but everybody else that had their suits on had the nice little, you know, thin tie, looked really proper, and he had his suit on, but he had this collar kind of flared out. He just, you know, obnoxious, just I don't know, it just that just spoke to me.
Yeah, he had the tie in the pocket of the suit.
Yeah.
And when the Rod Taylor and Catherine Spark character started speaking in French, because she was French, of course, he said, don't speak in French, I don't understand it. And he looked at her when he said that.
Yeah, he was kind of the quintessential, I don't want to say ignorant American, but he was just like, you know, I'm the king of my castle, and, you know, that's what – the difference between him and Rod Taylor, you could see why she, you know, gravitated toward this guy who had culture, class, And then she's with this – and McCarthy, I think Sammy on Gentleman's Guide actually was talking about meeting him a few times. I think actually standing in front of a urinal doing their business. And he said he just started talking. He said, man, what a great guy. But I saw him in so many movies where he was such an asshole. but, you know, that's great because that means if he was really a great guy, what an actor, you know.
Yeah, and the thing is that that's the way to get a long career is to play assholes.
Yeah. Well, I play an asshole every day, and, you know, my career is doing pretty well, so yeah, I can attest to that.
I'll have to keep that in mind for my future career path.
There you go.
Okay. Okay, so we'll take another break now, and then we'll get back with one of the few sport films I like, Banning, with Robert Wagner, Jill St. John, and some very interesting other actors.